Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Some of the most ancient documents we have, whether cuneiform or stone inscriptions, has to do generally with one of two topics. The first is tax records, so the government can see where money is coming and going. And the second has to do with military peace treaties. That's because some historians, like John Keegan, argue that the written history of the world is largely a history of warfare. Well, that's not a popular view today, because a lot of historians look at history from the social or cultural level and look how distinct groups of people interact with one another, whether trade guilds, peasants, maybe marginalized members of society. But the truth is, the military really does have a huge impact on history. One example is how modern-day borders are drawn up, and a lot of them have to do with where battles happened and which side won. Well, to get into this concept a little bit more, I am joined by Carl Rylett, host of the History of Europe Key Battles podcast. This podcast does exactly what it claims to do, looks at how the formation of Europe happened through its military clashes and key battles. Today, we're specifically going to look at the Siege of Kazan, between the emerging Russian Empire in the 1550s and the Khanate of Kazan, which was a daughter state of Genghis Khan's Great Horde. In the aftermath of Russia's success, Russia was able to conquer the Volga River basin, go to the Caspian Sea, eventually push all the way through Siberia into the Pacific, and become a great power. So the Siege of Kazan looks like a small military conflict in 1552, but it had huge results that altered world history. So let's jump right into this, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Carl from the History of Europe Key Battles podcast. Carl, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this topic because you focus primarily on military history. And this is interesting because 100 years ago, 150 years ago, if someone were to purchase a book on history, it would probably be a book on military history or maybe diplomatic treaties or one of these so-called great men of history like a Napoleon or Alexander the Great. But these days, the trend is social history. There's so much of a focus on social groups, peasants, other people, that it seems like some academic historians act like a Napoleon doesn't even really matter that he existed, because if not for him, someone else would have come along that would have fulfilled the same role. But for you, what do you think is the importance of military history in general?
Well, for me, it's not the military aspect itself. What I became interested in was why certain battles affect the political, the social map of Europe as we have now. I started becoming interested in history probably about 15 years ago. I lived in Switzerland at the time, and I'd lived in Russia and Spain before, and wanted to understand the cultures. And in order to understand the cultures, I thought the history is important for that. So when I thought about doing a podcast, I thought one way of doing that would be talking about the grand sweep of history, but using different battles as kind of milestones in that kind of story of the grand sweep. And so, yeah, that's where my interest really came from.
And in Europe in particular, because that's what you're focusing on, you go way back to antiquity, and then your narrative really kicks in the early Middle Ages. How do you think battles and military history has particularly caused the formation of Europe and given it its particular characteristics?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Some battles have been important to define political borders when one state defeated another. For other battles, one victory over another became symbolic, and that symbolism became an important in itself. It helped define the culture, the religion. When a Muslim power such as the Ottomans fought against the Russians, that balance of power, which turned out in the end, was important for defining the border between the Islamic world and the Christian world.
Yeah, that's true. I think a lot of people don't appreciate how many borders are there just because, well, that's where the army stopped. And I mean, at least one that I'm aware of, and I'm sure you're aware of others, is the border of modern day Turkey, which is just a little rump in the European side. Most of it's on the Asian side. is simply where the Ottoman army stopped in the Balkan Wars in 1912-1913, and that's it. No mountain range, no ideological difference, no difference in ethnic groups. That's it. The military stop. Are you, off the top of your head, are you aware of any other borders like that, that due to some battle or something else, that's why we have this or that modern day border?
Well, there's perhaps the borders around between France and Germany. There were several battles in the Middle Ages involving the state of the then Duke of Burgundy, and that affected the current borders between France and Germany. And of course, later on, obviously, during the Second World War, when France and Germany fought each other, that kind of decided where the current border lies. I mean, that's all due to events. There's no God-given reason why the border between France and Germany is where it is at the moment. It was defined by events, and it could have been elsewhere. The people who live near the border at the moment, say in Alsace, in France, if things had been different, could easily have been born in Germany, which makes you kind of realize that kind of our national identities are often an accident of history.
Right. There's so many contingencies we take for granted. Well, I'd like to dive into something that you've been going through now in your podcast, and you've covered all sorts of battles in all sorts of locations through the Crusades and the Hundred Years' War. Something you're focusing on now is the Siege of Kazan, which takes place in Russia in the 16th century, a place that people probably wouldn't think about, but I'm kind of excited to get into this because I know bits and pieces of this time period, and it connects to the Ottoman Empire, which I'm a fan of. So I'm looking forward to this, but could you set the stage for me? So it's the 16th century. Where is Russia right now?
So Russia at that time, it had managed to come out of centuries-long period of Mongol domination, sometimes called the Tatar yoke. Because if you go back to the 1200s, that's when the forces of Genghis Khan invaded Russia and basically dominated Russian lands for the next couple of centuries. Before then, Russia was disunited in several different city-states. But the city which emerged as the most powerful as the Mongols begin to decline in power was that of Moscow. And so they gradually assimilated more and more lands. They gained control over other Russian towns. Kazan is interesting because it's probably the first non-Russian city which Moscow managed to take control of. So it's probably not very well known at all, Kazan. It became briefly famous a little bit because it was one of the cities in the World Cup last month in Russia. But it's an interesting city. It's the majority population are actually still Muslim. There's about 50-60% of people are Muslim. The other people are all Orthodox. And they still retain a strong sense of their Tatar past. So it's located a little bit east of Moscow, along the River Volga. So situated in a very important point in the trade networks down to the Caspian Sea and then further along into Asia and the Silk Roads. And so the Kazan city was the center of the Kazan Khanate, which was one of the splinter states from the Tatar days, from the days of the Mongols. The Golden Horde, as it was, kind of disintegrated at the end of the 1300s and then broke up into the Khanate of Crimea was one of them, Kazan, Siberia, the Great Horde. But Kazan was the one which was closest to Russia and the one which was most tempting to attack.
And could you help me understand, how would Russia regard the Tatars, this Khanate? Would they consider them as kind of equal political partners as their European neighbors on their west, or the way that people thought of the Mongols in 19th century as kind of the scourge or this inferior partner to Russia, to this nascent state? How do they consider this Khanate?
Well, they had, as I said, suffered centuries of domination by the Mongols, and so they had were part of the reason why Moscow was becoming more gaining prestige, is that it was involved in some of the battles which then pushed back the Mongols. Most notable ones being the Battle of Kulikova in 1380, and later pushed back nearly 100 years later, the Battle of the River Ugra. And so, yeah, they were, as I say, the Khanates were, at that time, they had splintered up and they were less weak. And so what it was all about for the then ruler of Moscow, who was the famous Ivan the Terrible, was asserting his power over his neighbours. So it wasn't just Kazan who he had his eyes on, but to the northeast had his eyes on the cities of Novgorod and the Duchy of Lithuania. So Russia was, or Muscovy at that time, was certainly more powerful, and it was asserting its power even ever more, becoming more confident. And Ivan also represented the fight against Kazan as a kind of crusade, because the Khanate of Kazan was Muslim. The Tatars had converted to Islam in the 1300s, and so that was an extra justification for attacking Kazan.
Can you walk me through what a Russian and what a Kazan soldier would look like? Did a Kazan soldier mostly still use the same Mongolian tactics? Maybe you're on a horse, you have a short recurve bow, and you use archer cavalry forces to do rapid strikes. Is that still what they're using? And what does it look like on the Russian side?
Yeah, to be honest, you probably got me there, because I'm not the actual details of the military weapons and that kind of stuff is something which I didn't research as much. It's more the political interaction between the different countries and states. But yeah, I mean, traditionally the Mongols came on horseback, so that was their main strength. That was certainly had been adopted to an extent. The Russians had also learnt from the Tatars on how to best use their cavalry. I can't give you a description of exactly what the Russian soldier would look like at that time.
Well, it's interesting that you described it as a crusade, because this is in the 16th century, but and everyone thinks about the Crusades from the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, when you have the four proper Crusades as they were retroactively labeled. But in the 1400s and well into the early 1500s, the rhetoric of Crusades in mainland Europe is very popular. When people talk about fighting the Ottomans or trying to reclaim Constantinople shortly after it's taken, before Europe just accepts that it's gone forever. But I didn't think about that with Russia using the language of Crusades. That's interesting. Is that that's how Ivan describes it?
Ivan does describe it as that way, yeah. I think it was partly just an excuse to attack Kazan, but it was a convenient one. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't that long before when the language of Crusades was still very active. After the main Crusades in the Middle East had finished, the Ottoman Empire, as I'm sure you're aware, was pushing into Europe, and the battles which occurred in Europe between the Ottomans and the Christians were often referred to as Crusades. The Pope would often use the idea of holy war to encourage the Christian powers to unite against the Ottoman threat.
Right. This is getting up to the height of the Ottoman Empire's power, when Sultan Suleiman is Sultan. This is in between two sieges of Vienna. Can't remember if the Ottomans have captured the Crimea at this point or not, but there's definite aggressive growth and expansion happening here. So
exactly. At that time, the Crimea was controlled by one of those Khanates, which I mentioned previously.
Right.
Who were allied to the Ottomans, but were independent from them.
Okay, so let's set the stage here to look at the Siege of Vienna in 1552. So can you set this up for me? How How is this set up? What are the pretenses that Ivan uses, and how does it begin?
So it was part of an ongoing conflict. Going back to the days of the Golden Horde, part of the reason for the justification was that there would be frequent raids coming from Kazan, as well as from the other Khanates against Muscovy. So there was partly a justification of defending his lands, and that's certainly true. I mean, there were, particularly from Crimea, but from the other Khanates as well, frequent raids. They would collect slaves on the way and take them back down and sell them to the Ottomans. And so that was one important reason. The other was certainly to gain control of the important trade network, as I mentioned, going down to the Caspian Sea. There was also, the question of crusade, but also the protection of Christians who lived in the territories of Kazan Khanate, protection of other kind of smaller tribes who Ivan wanted to ally with, and that was important as well. At the end of the day, all these were kind of reasons made up in retrospect. Ivan believed in wanting to expand his empire in all directions, and Kazan was conveniently on his border.
And where is this in Ivan's reign? Is it early on? Is it a few years after he's consolidated control? Is it at the end of his reign?
So this is fairly early on. In the first years of his reign, Ivan was a minor. So the actual control of Muscovy was in the hands of nobles, something which annoyed Ivan greatly. And as soon as he came of age, he grasped power for himself. So this was probably the first major campaign which Ivan embarked on to go into Kazan.
And the Khanate of Kazan, is it pretty stable at this point, or has it been weakening, or where is it now?
So the Khanate of Kazan has been very weak for some time. It never really established a sense of identity and a kind of centralized power ever since it was created. It was just a kind of fragment that ended up almost by accident from the disintegration of the Golden Horde. And it was always being interfered with by its neighbors. So the most powerful Khanate at the time was probably that of Crimea, which was trying to assert its authority in Kazan. So in many ways, the battle for Kazan was actually a kind of a conflict between Muscovy and between Crimea. For years, they'd kind of been to-ing and fro-ing. The Crimeans would install their puppet leader in Kazan, and then the Russians would come over and put theirs on the throne. Kazan was extremely weak state at the time of the siege.
Yeah, and I'll be interested to hear what a siege is like for a state like Kazan, because when we imagine a siege, we think of a medieval castle or some walled city in Europe that's a capital of a bureaucratic and hierarchical empire where there's an administration, there's a bureaucracy, there are distinct class divisions. But for basically a semi-nomadic tribal confederacy like Kazan, like you said, the rule is very indirect. It's semi-nomadic. The city itself is more of a trading post and a slave market and things like that. So when the siege begins, when Russia comes, what does it look like for Kazan, which is a host of a confederacy that wouldn't probably have these thick European walls?
It's true that it was came from a nomadic background, but the Tatars had settled down probably for some centuries by this time. You know, it was just a potential city. It had a big wall over it and protected by a river as well. So it was going to be always a hard task to take it.
Okay, so obviously we know what you focused on, the result of the siege, where Russia is victorious. So what are the results of that, and what are the implications? Because neither one of these states are enormously powerful at this point. In our mental map, we think of them as being on the fringes of Europe, although in their own story, they would be the center of that. But what are the results, and why do you think this has such important implications?
Well, I think the particular importance of Kazan was that, as I say, it was the first kind of non-Russian state that Muscovy was able to take control of, and it kind of opened up the rest of Asia to later conquest. Just a few years after the fall of Kazan, Ivan pushed even further and managed to take control of another khanate, which was called the Khanate of Astrakhan, which was based on the mouth of the River Volga on the Caspian. So within a few years, Ivan had suddenly expanded his empire. Well, I use the word empire. I mean, this is probably the first time that we can begin to talk of an empire, of a kind of multinational organization rather than a kind of homogenous Russian state. So I think this is one of the most important battles in European history. It fundamentally altered the balance of power of the Eurasian steppe. It was clearly the most powerful state in the region from then on, was able to push back on its main rival, the Crimean Khanate, and was able then to push further east, eventually, of course, reaching as far as the Far East in the Pacific. That took several years. But it was but that first stage was Kazan. A few years after the fall of Kazan, Russian merchants went into Siberia and they started to build up trade networks there, and it just went on from there.
And that's something that absolutely boggles my mind when you look at a map in the 16th or 17th century, when an area as large as Russia, which could be twice as far latitudinally than the United States, is under the control, I mean, albeit quite loosely, but still without the benefit of any modern transportation, without railroads, with anything, any sort of steam vessels, crossing over mountainous areas, rivers that are frozen several times of the year. So the fact that they can at least have a footprint on that large of a territory, it's just still mind-boggling when I see that, when you think about how difficult transportation is at this period in the early modern era.
Absolutely, yeah. It's an incredible story. I mean, it's sometimes the Russian expansion into Siberia is sometimes compared with what happened in America, of the Europeans moving in and taking control of the huge continent there.
And I forget where I heard this from, but in my history graduate program, there was a professor of Imperial Russian history that mentioned that, I think up to the 16th century, and I don't know if this included Ivan or not, but part of the way that you would claim legitimacy as a Russian ruler is to state that in addition to being the heir of the Orthodox tradition as the protector of orthodoxy, especially after Constantinople falls, and the protector of the Russian people, you also inherit the legitimacy of the great Khan himself, Genghis. So even though you're a Christian ruler, you're claiming his legitimacy. And then after the 16th century, when Russia overthrows these different Khanates, they no longer claim that. But I thought that was interesting that they're still part of this Eurasian political game that their neighboring Khanates are part of.
Exactly. I think that's another important point, another kind of justification for Ivan claiming his right of authority on the different Khanates. Russia was part of the Great Horde, if you like. So if he was just as much likely to be a successor as any other of the splinter Khanates.
Well, this might be a little bit of a preview of things that you're going to look at coming ahead on your podcast, but as the story of Russia goes on, at what point do they start to become a big player in the European political and military game and start to threaten the Ottomans from the north? How many decades or centuries do you think that takes until they really emerge?
So as far as the south is concerned, there were a number of wars, I think at least 9 Russo-Turkish wars during the 1700s and 1800s. One of the key moments was the Battle of Kagul in 1770, as part of that was under the rule of Catherine the Great, when the Russians were pushing down south. And a few years later, in 1783, the Russians annexed Crimea. So that was the kind of period when Russia was starting to assert its control over former Ottoman lands. And from that state, as you must be aware, the Ottomans were becoming weaker and weaker. It was just a question of how fast the Ottoman Empire would decline and whether it would be Russia or some other country which would benefit from that.
Right. Well, there's contemporary relevance with that today with capturing the Crimea. So history might not repeat itself, but it definitely does rhyme. So, yeah, well, Carl, thank you for going over this. And you have covered a lot of other battles, too, which people can check out. So where is the best place for people to find you online if they want to see the other battles you've covered?
Sure. Well, you can find me on my blog site, which is www.historyeurope.net. You can, of course, find me on iTunes or any of the podcatchers to search for History of Europe Key Battles. Yeah, so that's where you can find me.
Great, and I'll link to that in the show notes. Carl, thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spy masters, Baron Freyza, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, and Melissa Sarnowski. And I'll explain what that means in a second. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are 4 easy ways for you to do it. 1, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and there you'll find instructions. 2, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. 3, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free, all 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the Scouts and Intelligence Officers, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you'll be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.